A flat look. It wouldn't be incorrect to assume the caller has a journalistic bent. Ethan opened his mouth to respond, but before he could form words, the exit door at the end of the hallway crashed open. Ethan and I both whipped around, hands on our swords. Two tall men in black suits, shades over their eyes, walked inside. One of the men carried a package wrapped in brown paper, the sides wrapped in black electrical tape. My heart thudded. I'd only seen packages like that on television cop shows, right before they exploded into shrapnel. Vampires didn't care for shrapnel, especially not the wooden variety. "Steady now, Sentinel," Ethan silently said to me, as if sensing my sudden fear. And since I was undoubtedly throwing magic into the air, he probably could.
"Can we help you, gentlemen?" Ethan asked.
Both men arched eyebrows over their glasses, but kept moving forward. Despite the thudding of my heart, I moved to stand beside Ethan, a barricade of vampires. A song from Les Miserables began, however inappropriately, to echo through my head.
"We have a delivery," said the man who wasn't holding the package.
He reached into a suit pocket, but Ethan had his sword up and out before the man could pull out whatever he was reaching for. I unsnapped the thumb guard on my handle.
"Whoa!"
said the man with the package, his Chicagoland accent heavy enough that it bled through the single word.
"We're only here to make a drop-off, right?"
He extended the package in his hands.
"You hold that," Ethan told him, then looked back at the man whose jugular was currently inches from the tip of his sword. "And you," he said to the other one, "pull that hand back very, very slowly."
The man swallowed, but did as he was told, and when his hand was clear of his jacket, he offered up a black leather wallet.
"Just getting the ID, pal."
"Open it," Ethan said.
He flipped it open, then held it out for Ethan to see, then me.
"I got an import-export business," he said. "I'm just a businessman."
"And what's in the package?"
The two men exchanged a glance.
"It's a gift for, the head honcho, if you get my meaning."
He winged up his eyebrows, as if willing Ethan to understand.
"For your head honcho?" Ethan asked.
The men nodded with relief. Apparently, they were members of the North American Central, and good at hiding that fact. And they were relieved not to have to admit it aloud. Maybe living in hiding wasn't as easy as Tony had made it out to be.
"And what's in the box?" Ethan asked.
The man with the package leaned forward, moistening his lips nervously.
"It's a rather fine vintage, if you get me. A vintage of the red variety. It's a gift from a family that's prominent here in Chicago, to the family of Mr. Keene."
"Ah," Ethan said aloud, then switched to silent mode. "What's in the box?"
I leaned down a little and frowned at it, clearing my mind to block out the extraneous noise and magic. But the box was a blank slate. No metal, no magic. So I switched to a simpler sense and took a sniff. There it was.
"It's booze," I said, standing straight again. "Good stuff, too, as far as I can tell."
The man without the package rolled his shoulders and adjusted his tie.
"Of course it's good. Who do you think we are, bit players?"
Ethan smiled politely, put his left hand on his scabbard, and carefully resheathed his sword. Then he stepped aside.
"Enjoy the convocation, gentlemen."
We turned to watch them proceed down the hallway.
"I believe those gentlemen are connected, Sentinel."
"They're related?"
"Connected to something a little more, shall we say, organized?"
It took a moment for the implication to sink in. Ethan thought they were mobsters.
"And you let them walk into the chapel?" "And with alcohol to boot. They're pack members with bounty in hand. We can't stop every pack member who tries to walk in the church with booze," he snickered. "The chapel would be empty."
I chuckled in spite of myself. He bobbed his head toward the kitchen door again.
"That was the kitchen?"
"Yep.
I'm going to get something to drink."
I followed him inside and waited by the door while he inspected the fridge. He pulled out a bottle of water, unscrewed the top, and took a long drink.
When he was done, he tossed the empty bottle and cap in a recycling bin, then nodded toward the door again. I was about to push it open when I froze. The exterior door at the end of the hall had been opened again, and I could hear voices moving toward us down the hallway. And this time, a metallic buzz accompanied them. It could have been something simple, shifters who carried weapons as part of their normal course of business, but this just felt wrong. Silently, I held up a hand to stop Ethan, then pointed at the door, then my ear, then held up two fingers. He nodded, moved forward, and put his ear to the door.
You think you can take him out? Asked one of them.
Damned right. The faster we get it done, the faster the money's in hand. So I'm definitely gonna take a goddamn chance at it, whispered another.
There was venomous anger in his voice.
Huh. I don't know if we can make this work tonight. Not like he wants us to. There's a lot of goddamn bodies gonna be in that room in a few minutes.
Ethan arched his brows at me. I nodded. Footsteps moved closer.
Weapons, I silently told him. Guns or knives, I don't know, but they're heavily armed.
Then let's move, he replied.
Ignoring the nervous flutter in my chest, I went first, pushing through the kitchen door. The two men, both in jeans, boots, and leather jackets, jumped as we appeared, hands moving toward their waists. I assumed they were reaching for guns. Gentlemen, I said, flipping the thumb guard on my katana and lifting it from its scabbard just enough to reveal the gleam of steel. What's happening? They looked at each other, then at me.
We have business here, vampire.
Yeah, I get that. The problem is, I'm getting the sense your kind of business won't be good for the rest of us. The one on the left, shorter, balding at the edges, took a half step forward. He flipped back the side of his leather jacket, revealing a handgun stuck into the waistband of his 1980-style jeans. At the sight of the gun, I dug my fingers into the handle of my katana to keep my hand from shaking. I'd already been shot twice this week. I wasn't eager for more.
Honey, why don't you and your little boyfriend here take your little knives and go for a nice long walk, all right? This ain't your concern.
Problem is, boss, I said, unsheathing my sword and enjoying the widening of their eyes.
It is our concern.
It sounds like you have some kind of issue with the leader of the pack, so to speak, and he's a friend of mine. The taller one, younger, cuter, but just as egotistical, elbowed his friend.
I'll take this one.
Get behind me, I told Ethan as the younger guy took a step forward. He reached inside his leather jacket and pulled a matte black handgun from an interior pocket.
You're cute, he said. So I'm gonna give you one more chance.
He waggled the gun in our direction.
Take a goddamn hike, and we'll go about our business, and everyone's happy. Right?
I had no doubt he'd pulled the trigger. He was the type, brave to the point of stupid, narcissistic in a completely self-defeating way. And although he knew we were vampires, he clearly had no understanding of what that really meant. That bullet, although it might hurt like a son of a bitch, would probably be pretty ineffective in taking me down. I rolled my eyes and rotated my wrist to turn the sword, then pulled out a threat that Selena had once used against me.
I'll have you down before you can snap off a shot.
Bitch,
he said.
That was the last thing he said. He lifted the gun, then raised his other hand to support it, but I was already moving. I rotated my body, bringing my leg around in a sweeping high kick that knocked the gun from his hands. It hit the floor and slid behind me, and I felt the air shift as Ethan reached for it. I completed the rotation, then shifted the weight of my sword and thrust the handle into his chest as hard as I could. In what seemed like slow motion, he umphed and fell backward, hands clawing at his breastbone. By the time he hit the ground, I righted my katana and held it before me, then glanced over at his shorter friend.
What about you, bud? You want to try me too?
Eyes wide and panicked, the air thick with fearful magic, he took a few shaky steps before turning for the exit. But help had arrived. Two blondish Keen brothers stood before the door, arms crossed and knowing gazes on the traitors in their midst. They must have sensed the trouble, or Fallon had sent them out here to keep an eye on me and Ethan. Bright girl. Excellent timing, I said, keeping an eye on the man on the floor until they could reach him. Both taller and brawnier than the interlopers, they had him in hand in a matter of seconds.
We do what we can, said the keen brother on the left, a grip on the collar of the man I'd knocked down.
It occurs to me we haven't met yet. I'm Christopher.
Ben, said the other one, who had the neck of the older man beneath his arm. The man struggled in the awkward position, but Ben didn't bat an eyelash.
I grinned back. Lovely to meet you both, I said, then glanced back at Ethan. He stared at me, his eyes pools of quicksilver. I guess I'd managed to impress him.
Not bad for a common soldier, hmm?
I quietly asked, then resheathed my katana and headed back toward the chapel. I could feel his gaze on my back as I walked away, so I decided to play it up. I paused at the sanctuary door, then looked back over my shoulder and smiled vampishly through hooded eyes.
Coming?
Without waiting, I walked inside. Now that, my friends, is what we vampires call a good exit. Chapter 18. Let's give him something to talk about. The chapel was nearly full when we returned, the room abuzz with enough magic and weaponry to give me a caffeine-esque buzz. Gabriel stood behind the podium, chatting with Adam and two other unfamiliar shifters. As we walked toward him, I noticed our would-be company men sitting in a pew, the box across the lap of the man who'd carried it in, both chatting politely with the shifters beside them.
We need a minute, Ethan told him, and Gabriel excused the others. I heard that there was commotion in the hallway.
Ethan nodded. We may have found the men who took the contract. We overheard them talking about the money and the hit, and they were well armed.
Gabriel's brows lifted. The guys sent to kill me talked about the hit in the church?
Not the brightest bulbs, I put in. Christopher and Ben approached Adam, then leaned in to whisper something to him. Adam nodded, then signaled to Gabriel.
They've been taken care of, Gabriel said flatly.
His tone raised the hair at the back of my neck, and I reminded myself never to cross him.
Can we proceed?
There's a chance that whoever put out the contract will try again, Ethan warned him. That we dealt with these two doesn't mean we eliminated the risk. Gabriel reached out and gave him a manly arm pat.
The show must go on.
With no fanfare and no introduction, Gabriel stepped to the lectern. Ethan and I took positions on his right. At his immediate left stood Robin and Jason. Adam and Fallon stood point on the far left. I found Jeff in the crowd, sitting on the end of the second pew, arms crossed over his chest, his expression grave. Gabriel began to speak, his voice booming through the church's speaker system, the sound bouncing across the stone walls. And weirder still, he recited a poem. It was Yeats, I think, if my nearly completed PhD in English Lit was working correctly.
I have heard the pigeons of the seven woods make their faint thunder, he said, and the garden bees hum in the lime tree flowers and put away the unavailing outcries and the old bitterness that empty the heart.
I couldn't help it. My jaw dropped. A room full of 300 shifters in varying degrees of denim and leather, carrying all manner of weaponry, was now staring rapt at the leader of the North American Central Pack of Shifters as he read a poem about nature. They nodded their agreement, heads bobbing like faithful parishioners in a church, which I suppose they were.
I have forgot a while. Terra uprooted, and the new commonness, upon the throne and crying about the streets, and hanging its paper flowers from post to post. Because it is alone of all things happy, I am contented.
Gabe paused, lifted his gaze, and lifted his hands to the crowd around him. They shouted their affirmations, some standing, some with hands raised, eyes closed rapturously as they celebrated the world and pronounced their contentment. Goosebumps rose on my arms, and not just because the magic in the room had reached electric levels.
For I know that quiet wanders laughing and eating her wild heart among pigeons and bees, while that great archer, who but awaits his hour to shoot, still hangs. A cloudy quiver. Over Parsnali, finished the entire group of them together, and then they burst into raucous applause.
Without waiting for the thunder to quiet again, Gabriel dropped the bomb.
Tony Marino, leader of the Great Northwestern Pack, is dead.
The chapel went immediately silent.
We convene today with four packs, but three alphas. When we are done, the Great Northwestern will begin the task of choosing another to speak for the communal voice, for the great family. But today, we must focus on the business at hand.
A tall, thin, rough-looking man stood up from his seat in the middle of the room and punched a finger in Gabe's direction.
Fuck that, he said. Our Apex, our father, is dead, and you tell us this now? This is bullshit.
More shifters popped out of their seats, their voices joining the clamor. You could see the pain in their faces, the shock of their loss. But that was nothing compared to their irritation at the leader of the North American Central. Adam, Jason, and the others tensed, moving a half step forward as if preparing for inevitable violence. I raised my right hand to the handle of my katana, the easier to free it should the need arise.
And you've brought goddamn vampires to a convocation, accused one man with a military-style crew cut. This is our meeting, our gathering, a gathering of pack, of kith and kin. They contaminate it.
Gabriel crossed his arms over his chest, waiting as they hurled insults and anger in his direction. He looked unfazed by the allegations, but I was close enough to feel the angry magic that arose from his body in a greasy wave. On the other hand, I understood now why he'd insisted on going forward with the convocation. There was a lot of emotion in the room, and the city was undoubtedly better served by allowing the shifters to hurl it in Gabriel's direction, instead of outside at the rest of Chicago. Gabe had broad shoulders. I had no doubt he could handle the barrage. After a few minutes, he held up his hands, and when that didn't work, he bellowed, in words and magic, across the room.
Silence!
To a man, the chapel quieted. And when Gabriel spoke again, there was no mistaking why he was Apex, or what repercussions would be for not heeding his word.
You are here because the packs have called a convocation. If you wish to have issues decided without your input, you needn't be here. All or any of you can stand up and walk out of this room with impunity.
He leaned over the lectern.
But whether you stay or leave, you will goddamn follow the dictates of the pack. That is our way. That is the only way, and that is not up for debate.
The collective energy in the room diminished, as if the shifters in the chapel had tucked their tails between their legs.
You're right, he continued. There are vampires in our midst, and that's a change in pack protocol. We aren't like them, and maybe we'll never heal the wounds between our people. But rest assured, war is coming, whether we like it or not. And you're right. There are vampires who care little for the packs, just as there are pack members who are willing to assassinate their alphas. But I have seen things.
You could have heard a pin drop in the room at that revelation. The pack members must have trusted in whatever prophecy Gabriel was about to make.
I have seen that future, he said. I have seen the future of my child.
He beat a fist against his chest.
My son! I have seen the face of those who will keep him safe when times become the hardest for all of us.
He dropped his gaze, and when he raised it again, knowledge in his eyes, he turned his head, and he looked at me. There was pleading in his eyes. My lips parted.
Vampires will keep him safe, he said,
and we stared at each other, and I saw the racing events of his future and mine in his eyes. No storyline, no dates, but I saw enough, including the eyes of his child, and another set of green eyes, eyes that looked nothing and everything like Ethan's. I had no way of knowing how powerful, how accurate a shifter's visions were, but it packed a punch. Tears stinging my eyes, Gabriel looked away again. I dropped my gaze to the floor, trying to take in what he'd said, trying to keep my breath from becoming so shallow that I passed out in the church.
Merritt,
Ethan silently asked, but I shook my head. This needed processing before it needed debate, before I'd be ready for discussing it, if I ever would be ready to discuss it. The crowd had quieted again, the weight of the information Gabriel had shared enough to make them contemplative, to make them seriously consider the things he was going to ask them.
You will face death, he told them. Tony's death, and possibly others if we stay. But we will face death if we go as well. The world is a harsh place, we know that. We live by its code, a different code from vampires or humankind, but our code just the same. That is the decision you must make tonight.
He held up his hands.
Let the decision begin.
Decision was a nice word for what commenced. As soon as Gabriel opened the floor to debate, most of the shifters who'd already bellowed at Gabriel flipped off the crowd and walked out. That prompted the remaining 200 shifters to stand and yell at the deserters. Chaos, indeed. Gabriel rolled his eyes, but saluted the walkouts.
Let them go, he said into the microphone. They aren't obliged to stay. None of you are required to stay. But whether you walk out or you stay and participate, you will abide by the decision made here.
It was clear by the tone of his voice and the menace in his eyes that he wasn't making a request. He was issuing an order, reminding the packs of their obligations. Those who chose to ignore those obligations did so at their own risk. The remaining shifters chastened. The debate over their future began in earnest. A microphone had been placed in the middle of the church center aisle for the shifters' use. I wasn't crazy about the location. It gave anyone who stepped up to the mic a direct shot at Gabriel. But there wasn't much help for it. But that didn't mean I couldn't be proactive. Without asking for Ethan's permission, I'd seen the fear in his eyes after I'd helped Berna beside the bar. I left my post at his side and walked to the front of the church, then stood directly in front of the podium. Bullets and shifters who wanted a shot at Gabriel would have to go through me first. Good thought, Ethan silently complimented, but a heads up would have been nice. Better to ask forgiveness than permission, I reminded him. Although the shifters were a rainbow of shape, size, and skin tone, the views they espoused at the microphone fell in two categories. Half were pissed at the thought of having to leave their homes and businesses for Aurora. They mostly yelled at us, screamed at Gabriel, made rude gestures. The other half wanted nothing to do with vampires or vampire politics, and they were convinced the threat to their well-being as a society was vampire in origin. They also mostly yelled at us, screamed at Gabriel, and made rude gestures. After long minutes of vitriolic monologues, the final speaker reached the microphone. He was tall and burly, a giant black leather vest over his barrel chest. He wore a bandana on his head, and his long beard had been bundled into consecutive bands. After waiting patiently for his turn to speak, he stepped up to the mic, then gestured toward Gabriel.
You know me, sir. I ain't one with words or talk. You know I work hard, follow the rules, do right by my family.
I couldn't see Gabriel's face, but given the soft earnestness in this big man's voice, I imagined he nodded in understanding.
I don't see the future, so I don't know about war. I tend to stick to my kind, and I don't know much about vampires or the like. I don't know what's coming down the road, what kind of things we'll see when the dust kicks up or when it settles again. Frankly, I don't exactly know why we're here or why we think we need to run.
He swallowed thickly.
but I've lived among humans for many, many moons. I've been in human wars and fought beside them when I thought it necessary. They've stood up to protect me and mine. I also heard talk these vamps did right by us. And here they are again, and they step up to protect you like they're willing to take any danger coming your way.
He half shrugged modestly.
Politics and such ain't my thing, but I know what's right. They step forward, but we don't?
He shook his head.
I don't mean disrespect to you or your kin, but that ain't right. It just ain't.
He nodded at me, this man in the leather vest, then turned and walked humbly back to his pew in the middle of the church. He slid inside, then sat down, blinking as he waited for whatever came next. My heart ached with emotion. I couldn't very well leave my post, but I watched him until he made eye contact, then offered a nod. He nodded back, two would-be foes acknowledging the virtue of the other. Life as a vampire wasn't always what I expected it to be.
As is our way, Gabriel said into the silence of the chapel. In the pews before you are two chits, one black, one white. Black, we return home to the sanctity of the Seven Woods. White, we stay. We risk the fight, whatever that fight may be. Place your vote in the box as it's passed. If you have a proxy, you may cast those votes as well. Cast your ballots according to your conscience, he said.
Jason stepped down from the platform, a wooden box in his hands. He carried it to the back of the chapel, then handed it to the last man in the last row. It took 18 minutes for the vote to be cast. 18 nerve-wracking minutes, during which most every shifter in the room gave me alternately curious and grave looks. I had to work not to shuffle uncomfortably under the weight of their collective stares. When the box had traversed the chapel, Jason hauled it back to the front of the room, and the counting began. A longboard, not unlike the marker for a cribbage game, was placed on the table where the box had rested. As each marble-shaped chit was pulled from the box, it was placed upon the holder. Black, then white, then black, then three whites, then six blacks, and so on. Although my new friend had spoken eloquently, the shifters hadn't been completely convinced. Whatever the vote, it wouldn't be unanimous. After a few minutes of counting, Gabriel stepped down off the platform, then beside me, moving closer to the crowd. He was symbolically rejoining them, committing to abide by their decision, whatever it might be. Gabriel held up a closed fist.
The final chit! The deciding chit!
He opened his palm. The marble was white. They were staying. For a full 5 seconds, there was silence. And then chaos broke out. We'd been right, unfortunately. Although the men in the hallway might have had it in for Gabriel, they weren't the only ones who did. And they hadn't cared about the vote. They planned to affect the balance of power afterward. The room erupted in sound as shifters began to rush the stage, ripping guns and knives from their leather as they moved. I was closest to Gabriel, so I unsheathed my sword and jumped in front of him until Ethan and Adam appeared to whisk him away and behind the podium. Gabriel protected, Fallon, Jason, and Robin jumped down to the chapel floor. Fallon pulled dual daggers from her boots and joined me at the front. Jason and Robin tapped Jeff, then moved to the sides of the chapel to rein in the attack from the sides. They weren't the only ones who jumped in to Gabe's defense. However the shifters might have felt about the vote, the chits had been cast, and the decision had been made. The rest of them would abide by the decision. They would stay and fight. And they would not abide traitors in their midst. Send Christopher and Ben to the exit doors, I silently told Ethan. If this thing spills outside, someone will call the cops. We don't need that right now. Fallon and I shared a nod, then prepared to wield our steel. The first wave was all bravado. A man in a leather jacket came at me with a murderous grin and a revolver. Oh, that's almost too easy, I said with a smile. And before he could snarl back, I wrapped my fingers around his trigger hand and twisted upward, keeping the handgun pointed at the ceiling and out of harm's way. I used the torque to bend his elbow, and he fell to his knees as tendon, sinew, and bone stretched to the breaking point. When he muttered a very few unclassy epithets, I decided he'd be happier unconscious. I slipped the gun from his hand, and a low kick to the side of his head put him out of commission. I glanced down at the raven bracelet on my wrist. It might not do much about animosity toward vamps, but it was great with the ass-kicking. The next shifter in line opted for a knife, and he was quicker than his now-sleeping friend. He used little thrusts and stabs that would have nailed me if I were a slower vampire. But I was fast, and I could dodge them, and he wasn't the most creative of fighters. Unfortunately for him, he used the same little thrusts and stabs over and over again. Disarming him was a cinch, and I put him out with a knee to the chest that knocked the wind right out of him. I glanced over and found Fallon eyeing me with amusement. "I like you," she said, her own pile of bloodied shifters at her feet. "You're very tidy." I grinned back. "I do hate mess." While we had a second, I glanced around to take in the rest of the action. There were keens posted at the back and side chapel doors to keep the melee contained. Jason and Robin stood in the wings, fighting back their own bands of angry shifters. Robin's lack of sight clearly didn't impact his ability to kick ass. About one-third of the congregation was still seated. The other two-thirds were fighting one another in whatever snug space they could find. "Quite a conference," I muttered, then positioned my body for round two. The second wave of attackers had seen us best the first wave, so their faces weren't nearly as confident, but they bore the grim, determined expressions of believers. They didn't care if they won or not. This fight was about principle. There were also smarter fighters. They'd waited to see the infantry move, and they knew how we'd fought. At least I got to use my sword for this round. The first shifter was a woman, a petite thing, with permed hair and curvy, gothic daggers in her hands. She was nimble with her steel and good at defending my slashes. But she didn't strike out. Her moves were all defensive. That meant, at least I assumed, that she'd tire out before I did. But there was no sense in delaying the inevitable. When she nicked me on the forearm, I put the final plan in motion. I slashed forward, rearranging our position so that she stood a few feet in front of the first pew, her back to the seat. A sideways kick to her torso threw her back against the bench. She hit the pew and slumped, hitting the ground, still upright, head forward as if in mid-nap. "Behind you!" Fallon yelled. I dropped down and heard the whoosh of a kick fly over my head. I rolled and kicked both legs out toward the shifter behind me. I wasn't close enough for a full contact shot, so he stumbled backward before regaining his balance and coming at me again. Fallon finished with her cluster of traitors, used one hand to tuck long curls behind her ear, then delicately stuck out a booted foot. The man tripped and went sprawling, arms pinwheeling as he hit the ground. Fallon nudged him on his back, then put a boot on his neck until he passed out from lack of oxygen. Hands on her hips, she glanced up at me. "I appreciate the help," I told her. "Anytime, you're good." "So are you," I said with a smile, thinking Jeff definitely had his hands full. The sanctuary was a mess. A couple of pews were broken. Candles were overturned, spilling wax onto the floor, and there were bullet holes in the marble columns. The violent shifters had been hauled into mostly unconscious piles, ready for their punishments. I wiped down my katana with the edge of my tank, then slid it back into its scabbard. It deserved a better cleaning, but that would have to wait until we were safe at home again. I scanned the crowd and found Jeff and Fallon in a corner. They chatted, their bodies close, their body language speaking of mutual concern and mutual interest. Jeff looked up and over. "You okay?" I mouthed. He gave me a thumbs up before turning back to Fallon. I'd all but lost him, I thought with a grin. But who better to keep Jeff busy and smiling than the gorgeous dagger-wielding heir to the North American Central Pack? Jeff secure, I moved back to the podium to check in with the bodyguards. Ethan, Adam, and Gabriel sat in the choir stalls. Ethan met my gaze and nodded, an employer satisfied with the effort of his employee. Unfortunately, this time it was Gabriel who'd taken a hit, a shot in his left bicep. Adam tended to it, wrapping what looked like an altar cloth around the wound to staunch the bleeding. Gabriel glanced up at me.
"So," he said, a hint of a smile at his lips. "I guess we're staying."
"That's what I hear," I said, then adopted a schoolteacher tone. "I'm really going to need to see some better behavior out of your children." He smiled grandly.
"I do enjoy your smartassery, kitten."
I nodded at the compliment, then looked to Ethan. "You okay?"
"Quite. You and Fallon made a good team."
"Don't give them any ideas," Gabriel muttered, then slid Adam a narrowed gaze. "Could you possibly make that tighter?" Adam gave him a grunty smile as he tied off the make-do bandage.
"I was taught by a certain big brother not to half-ass things."
"Yeah, and look how well that turned out for me," Gabriel said, ruefully, surveying the sanctuary. "We've half destroyed a church. Although the damage still isn't as bad as the 92 con pack."
"Or 94, Adam added with a wicked smile. He rubbed a hand across his stomach. 94 was a wild ride.
Gabriel gave him a gravelly chuckle, then knocked knuckles with his brother.
"True, true."
"What will happen to the fighters?" I asked. Gabriel stood, cradling his arm.
"We'll have a little discussion about pack behavior and what it means to abide by pack rules."
"They try to take you out, and they just get a discussion?" I wondered aloud. Gabriel gave me a sardonic look.
"I don't mean discussion, literally."
"Will you punish them the same?" Ethan asked. "I mean, those who set up the hit and those who actually tried to take you out?" Gabe muttered something I didn't catch. Given his tone, I assumed it was unflattering about vampires.
"We don't just line them up and start shooting, Sullivan. There are degrees of culpability, just like in the human world. As for convocation, the decision's been made, irrespective of the contract or the hit. They voted the way they voted, and the packs will stay."
He glanced over at Ethan.
"The things we discussed, about friendship? My people are too wired for that right now. Maybe in the future, maybe never, but certainly not right now."
Ethan did a good job of maintaining his composure in the face of Gabriel's rejection, but I knew he was cursing inside. He'd practically bet the house, or at least his sentinel, on the possibility of an alliance between Cadogan and the pack.
"Understood," Ethan said, "but the contract wasn't fulfilled. You're still alive. That means there's still a possibility someone will take a shot."
Gabriel shook his head. "Pack leadership passes through the family. So if something happens to me, Fallon becomes Apex, then Eli, and so on down to Ben and Adam. The only reason to try to take me out would have been to influence the vote. But the die's been cast, so there's no chance of that now." He shrugged. "By my math, I'm off the hook." I wasn't sure if I bought Gabriel's theory, especially since the violence had erupted after the vote was counted. But I understood the urge to move on and clear the vampires out of his belfry. Besides, we couldn't guard him 24 hours a day. We barely had staff enough to cover our own house. Gabe held out his uninjured hand to Ethan.
"Thank you again for your help. Your sentinel does good work."
They shook hands.
"That she does," Ethan said.
"Might be time to think about that raise."
"Don't push your luck, Sentinel."
A girl had to try. I'd stripped off my leather jacket when we returned to the Mercedes, the June heat providing more than enough insulation. But it took a few minutes of driving before I noticed the tiny nubbin in the pocket. "Oh, damn," I muttered. Ethan looked over in alarm.
"What?"
I reached into the jacket pocket, then pulled out the earpiece Luke had given me. "I totally forgot to use this." An eyebrow quirked up. Ethan reached inside his own jeans pocket and pulled out his earbud. I guess I hadn't been the only forgetful vampire. He offered me a secret smile.
"Let's not tell Luke about this, perhaps."
"You know what else?"
"What's that, Sentinel?"
I also forgot my cabbage rolls. He rolled his eyes, but he was grinning when he did it. You'll have to live without them, because you couldn't pay me enough to go back to that church. Too much shifter tonight? By a large degree, Sentinel. And the irony is, we've convinced them to stay. Well, that's kind of a victory, isn't it? Given our other options, I suppose so. You did good today, and I mean that sincerely. You showed a lot of bravery, and you executed well. Your work honors Cadogan House. Ethan's tone was solemn, earnest. I'd heard his master vampire tone of appreciation. This was different. More like affection than professional approbation. And since he was the one who'd pushed me away, something he'd undertaken at his own risk, I opted to ignore the undercurrent. Being rejected and trying to stay professional, pushing down my own feelings to stay focused on the task at hand, was hard enough on its own. I couldn't bear his remorse, too, and it wasn't fair for him to try to use me to make himself feel better. So I kept the mood light. Least I could do. He shifted in his seat, as if preparing a monologue. I thought quickly, then made my move. I turned on the radio, found a station playing a song I had to sing along with, then rolled down my window. I leaned an elbow on the door and turned my face to the wind, letting the city and the sound roll over me. The rest of the ride was quiet. Maybe he got the hint. Chapter 19, Girls' Night Out. When we arrived back at the house, Ethan gave me the final hours of darkness off, then headed to the ops room to update Luke. I immediately headed to my room and into the shower to scrub off the residue of magic, then pulled on a t-shirt and yoga pants and made my way to the second floor kitchen. The convocation had been draining, physically and emotionally. I finished off 2 pints of blood from the fridge's stash before I felt balanced again. When I was satiated, and after I'd texted Mallory to let her know Ethan and I had come through the convocation unscathed, I decided to check in on Linz. It would have been just as easy to lock myself in my room with a good book, but I was house social chair. No harm in making good on that promise. I could hear her room before I could see it, as noise spilled out into the hallway from Lindsay's open door. I peeked inside and found Margot, Lindsay, and Michelle preparing for what looked like a late evening on the town. "Hey," Lindsay said, waving from her spot in the front of the mirror. "We were just about to come and get you." "Since you managed to kick some ass at the convocation," the room broke out into applause. "We've decided we're sweeping you off to Temple Bar." "We want you to know we support you," Margot said with a nod and a grin, raising a glass of red wine. "Especially since you've been very,
ill-used," Michelle offered.
Margot smiled slyly. "Thanks, Shell. Ill-used." "It's Cadogan only night at Temple," Lindsay said, "which means no humans and no Navarre vamps in attendance. So we're gonna spend our final hours before dawn having a couple of drinks, unwinding, and generally having fun. No masters allowed. And this isn't an optional trip," she added, when I opened my mouth to beg off. "It's been a long day."
"Which is exactly why you need this," Lindsay said.
"Is there any chance I'm getting out of it?"
"Not even slightly."
"Then I guess I'm in." Lindsay winked, but then she frowned as she took in my loungewear. "First things first, the wardrobe." She turned back to the other vampires and twirled a finger in the air. "Saddle up, then meet us in the lobby in 20. The cab should be there by then." When she'd cleared them all out, we walked back down to my room. "So," she said when she finally perched in front of my open closet door, "this is the first time you've gone out with us since commendation. It's also the first time you've gone out since you were, you know, dumped, thrown back, replaced?
Is there a polite way to say it?"
"Not really. What's your point?"
"My point is, the best revenge is a life well lived, or whatever. That means you need to look completely insanely fabulous, and you need to have a fantastic time."
She pulled a pale blue sleeveless shirt with a draping neckline from a hanger, then grabbed a pair of straight-legged black pants.
The outfit assembled, she turned back to me. The place will be full of Katagun vamps, and you know how word travels.
That means it's time to teach him a lesson.
I grimaced. I didn't want to play the teaching Ethan a lesson game, especially since I was working on swearing him off. But I knew when I'd been beat. I held out a hand, then opened and closed my fingers. Gimme, I said, then took the bundle and headed for the bathroom. 10 minutes later, I emerged ponytailed and lipsticked. My beeper clipped at my waist. Lindsay had demanded I wear my hair up. Combined with the drapey neckline, she'd explained, it was the vampire way of announcing that you were single and that your carotid was available. I wasn't much interested in looking for love, but I figured arguing the point would just take too long. We headed downstairs where the rest of our entourage waited in equally trendy, neck-bearing attire. Like a woman on a mission, Lindsay gave a hand signal, and we all dutifully filed outside. A line of black and white cabs was parked outside the house, ready to ferry us to Temple Bar. The official Katagun House watering hole was situated in my favorite neighborhood, Wrigleyville, just blocks from Wrigley Field. Paparazzi snapped pictures as we crammed into the cabs, and their comrades-in-arms were waiting outside the bar when we arrived 15 glorious traffic-free minutes later. There were obvious advantages to doing most of your driving while most of the population was asleep. We were ushered into the bar, a private party sign on the door, warning humans and others that they wouldn't make the grade tonight. Membership, I supposed, did have its privileges. Even as late in the night as it was, the bar was still hopping, the two bartenders, Sean and Colin, passing out drinks while classic rock played on the stereo system. Lindsay led us through the crowd of vamps to a table marked Reserved. Unlike Katagun House, Temple Bar lacked fine antiques and carefully chosen paintings. But it did have new and vintage Cubs gear of every shape and size, vintage jackets, pennants, bobblehead dolls. As you might imagine, I felt right at home. We'd only just pulled out chairs and taken our seats when Sean popped up on the other side of the table. Like Colin, Sean was tall and lean, and he had short, ruddy hair framing an oval face and bright blue eyes. Sean was handsome in a kind of earnest, old-fashioned way, as if he might have stepped out of the photograph of a World War II battalion. On the other hand, he was a vampire and immortal. He might very well have been a member of a World War II battalion. Sean crossed his arms and looked us over with amusement. And what brings Katagun's finest to our little neck of the woods tonight? Everyone pointed at me, my cheeks heated. Ah, he said, then glanced over at me. So our sentinel has finally escaped the confines. She has, Lindsay said, wrapping an arm around my shoulders. She's done her duty with the shifters, and now she's working on a little oblivion. What would you recommend? He said, looking me over. Girly or manly? I blinked at him. I'm sorry. He moved around to my side of the table, then crouched down on one knee, one hand on the back of my chair. Women who drink socially tend to fall into two categories, he said, with the confidence of a sociologist or purveyor of spirits, the jobs probably having a lot in common. Women who drink girly. Women who stick to colorful things and martini glasses, white wine, frozen drinks. And women who drink manly. Women who aren't afraid to sip at a good Irish whiskey or a bit of stiff scotch. Which type of woman are you, Sentinel O'Mine? I smiled back at him from beneath my bangs. Why don't you decide? He winked. I do like a girl with moxie. Well, he was definitely going to like me. Sean apparently deemed me worthy of a manly drink. He brought back a chubby glass half filled with ice and golden liquid. You can handle this, he advised in a whisper, then moved on to put drinks in front of everyone else. Cautiously, I lifted the glass and took a sniff. I'd never been much of a drinker, and this smelled only slightly more palatable than diesel fuel. But I like the idea of being the girl who ordered a scotch on the rocks, assuming that's what this was. There was something kick-ass about it, like being a girl who drove a Wrangler, the girl who wore her boyfriend's jeans, the girl who played flag football with the guys on a cool fall day. And won. I lifted the glass and took a cautious sip. Then spent the next few seconds coughing. Margot, laughing beside me, patted me on the back. How's that drink, Sentinel? I shook my head, a fist at my mouth as I tried to catch my breath.
Rocket fuel,
I wheezed out.
Did you let him choose your drink?
I nodded.
Yep, that's your mistake. Never let Sean or Colin choose the drink merit. They have a sadistic side.
But they do the same thing to everyone, if that makes you feel better. She lifted her glass.
Welcome to the club.
Speaking of the club, I asked her, motioning to the partygoers around us. Where did all these people come from? There must be 100 vampires in here.
Remember, there are still 300 and something vamps affiliated with Katagun, even if they don't live in the house. For some strange reason, those couple hundred have no desire to play vampire sorority girls and hang out with the rest of us.
Given the week I'd had so far, I didn't think there was much mystery as to why. We spent the next hour chatting, me holding the drink in my hands as if it were providing necessary warmth, and taking a sip only when my throat had cooled down sufficiently from each previous drink. The vampires around me regaled me with stories of life in Katagun House. From the time the fire alarm sounded during the 2007 commendation, to the 1979 boycott of Blood for You, to the breaching of the gate by a fusty Hyde Park resident who was convinced the house was the site of secret occult rituals. Suddenly, Margot put down her drink, pushed back her chair, then stood up on it. When she was standing, she motioned to the bar. Sean grinned back and rang a brass bell that hung from a short post behind the bar. The entire room erupted into raucous applause.
What's going on? I murmured to Lindsay, but she lifted a hand.
Just keep listening. You'll get it.
Katagun vampires, Sean yelled,
as every vampire in the bar quieted again.
It is now time to partake of a proud Temple Bar tradition. Not that the tradition is proud, but Temple Bar certainly is.
Long live Temple Bar, shouted the vampires in unison.
Sean offered a kingly bow, then gestured toward Margot.
There was hooting in the crowd, then the squeak of wood on wood as chairs were turned to face her. She raised her hands.
Ladies and vampires, she shouted. It's time for a round of drinks, honoring the various and sundry personality tics of the master with the mostest, Ethan Sullivan.
I couldn't stop the grin that spread across my face.
Tonight, we welcome into our sacred covenant, our sentinel.
She lifted her glass to me, as every other vampire in the room did the same. Cheeks flushed, I raised my still, mostly full glass to the rest of them, bobbing my head in acknowledgement. Margot looked at me, glass still raised, and winked.
And may Lacey Sheridan, God bless her soul, choke on it.
The room burst into applause. My cheeks ached from the smile on my face. Lindsay leaned over and pressed a kiss to my cheek.
I so told you you needed this.
I very definitely needed this, I agreed.
Everyone have fun, Margot said. Everyone drink within reason. And afterward, everyone make use of Chicago's greatest attraction, public transportation.
With the help of the vampire beside her, Margot stepped down and took her seat again. Everyone at our table set down their glasses and moved their chairs in a bit closer.
All right, I said, shyness gone. So what exactly are we doing here?
Well, Sentinel, Margot said, may I call you Sentinel?
I grinned and nodded. She nodded back.
I don't think we're giving anything away by saying that our dear master and liege, Ethan Sullivan, is a little bit...
particular, Lindsay finished. He's very, very particular.
Yeah, I said dryly. I had a sense.
He's also a creature of routine, Margot explained. Of personality tics and habits, quirks, you might say, that can grate on the nerves.
Like the tag in the back of a really scratchy sweater, Lindsay suggested.
Margot winked at her.
Every so often, we gather together. We take a little time, a little cathartic time, to vent about those quirks that drive us crazy. Elbows on the table, I leaned forward. So which of the quirks are we talking about? First item on the list, the raising of the eyebrow.
To demonstrate, she arched a carefully sculpted black brow of her own, then peered around at each of us.
Drink,
Lindsay yelled, and we all took a sip. I hate it when he does that, Michelle said, gesturing with her drink, and he does it constantly.
It's like the world's worst irritating nervous twitch,
I agreed.
Nervous my ass, Margot said. He thinks it's intimidating.
It's the gesture of the master vampire speaking to a lowly novitiate.
Her voice had deepened into an obnoxiously crisp imitation of the perfectly condescending master vampire tone. Maybe she had a little master in her as well.
What's number two? I asked.
I got this one, Lindsay said. Number two. When Ethan refers to you, not by your name, but by your title. She dipped her chin and looked at me through hooded eyes.
Sentinel, she growled out.
I snorted. I always thought you looked familiar.
Drink,
Margot yelled, and we raised our glasses again. The next hour and a half continued in pretty much the same fashion. Ethan, maybe not surprisingly, had a lot of tics and quirks. That meant a lot of drinks. And if anyone came up with a quirk not cataloged before, we had to take a double round. Since I'd made virtually no headway with my manly drink, Sean took pity on me and brought over a plastic cup of ice water. That I wasn't drinking alcohol didn't make fun at the expense of the most pretentious of vampires any less enjoyable. We drank for every mention of Amit Patel, for every speech Ethan gave about duty, for each mention of alliances, for each time he answered a knock at his office door by saying simply, "Come." We drank for each time he jiggled his watch, each time he straightened his cufflinks, each time he shuffled papers when you reported to him in his office. Ethan had quirks enough that half the table had switched to soda or water by the time we were through. Ethan had quirks enough that I had to excuse myself from the table. And that was why I was on the way back to the table from the back of the bar when I saw them. Photos that had been tacked to the wall. Decades of pictures of vampires together, all taken at Temple Bar.
Cool,
I murmured, my gaze scanning the gathering of pictures. There were afros and disco wear, 1980s hairstyles and shoulder pads, and a picture that was half tucked into a corner of the display. With my fingertips, I turned the photograph on its thumbtack pivot to get a better view. The white Polaroid border framed a beautiful boy with cut cheekbones and a fall of blonde hair across his face. At his side was a blonde girl, her arm tucked into his, a martini glass in their hands. He looked at her, with adoration in his eyes. My stomach knotted. It was Ethan and Lacey, a picture taken some years ago, given the outfits in the photograph, but a picture of them just the same. A boy and girl, happy together. Love in their eyes. I slid the picture back into its place, partially hiding it from view, but there was no unringing the bell. He definitely had feelings for her. And after he'd slept with me, he'd called her back. I leaned against the wall and closed my eyes. I couldn't begrudge him love. I couldn't. Not if that was what they'd had together. But goddamn, I rue being in the middle of it, being the trigger for his reminiscence of that emotion. Sometimes knowledge did no one any good. I stood in the hallway for a few seconds until I was ready to face the vampires again. When I finally returned to the table, I paused at my chair and touched Lindsay's shoulder. She looked up, her smile fading as her gaze tracked my face.
Are you okay?
I nodded.
I'm fine.
I hitched a thumb toward the front door.
I'm going to go take a little breather.
You sure you're okay?
I gave her my best smile.
I'm fine, really. I just want to go get some air. That was the truth. My shifter magic-induced headache wasn't helped by the spilt magic of 100 vampires. She looked at me for a moment, apparently debating whether I was telling the truth.
You need company?
I'm fine. I'll be back in a few minutes,
Okay, but if you meet any cute humans out there who need any blood work, you let me know. You'll be the first vampire I call. I wove through the bar to the front door, then accepted a hand stamp from a cute, smiling, curly-haired vamp at the door. Once prepped for re-entry, I walked down the sidewalk, my gaze on the restaurants, bars, and eclectic shops that filled this part of Wrigleyville. I figured I might as well scope out interesting places to visit the next time I made the trip. I just passed a dusty used bookstore, now at the top of my to-visit list, when I heard footsteps scratch on the sidewalk behind me. I instinctively put a hand at my waist, at the place my sword would usually be belted, before realizing I'd left it at the house.
"You wouldn't need it, even if you did have it," said a low voice behind me.
Chapter 20, What's in a Name? I froze, then glanced back over my shoulder. Jonah stood in a puddle of streetlight, auburn hair kind of curving softly around his face. He wore a snug, dark button-up shirt with jeans and brown boots on his feet.
"Merritt," he said.
I lifted my eyebrows.
"Jonah?"
"I was in the neighborhood. Gray House isn't far from here, right?"
"It's down Addison," he said, then bobbed his head to the left. "A little farther west. It's a converted warehouse."
"And you decided to take a walk and see what was happening at the Cadogan House bar?" Jonah looked away for a moment before meeting my gaze again.
"It may not be entirely coincidental that I'm here."
I waited for elaboration. When none